My name is Eugene Meyer. I'm the president of the Federal Society, and I want to welcome all of you to the Reagan Library and to our conference on federalism and freedom. This is, I think, the 10th year we've had this conference at the library. We are delighted to have all of you here and appreciate your coming. And there's probably no more appropriate topic in many ways to be connected with President Reagan than a conference on federalism and freedom. Nor is there a more appropriate speaker in many ways to open our conference than one we're honored to have here today, because federalism includes obviously taking the states and their role in our government seriously, and Attorney General Scott Pruitt of the state of Oklahoma has done exactly that and taken the lead in many ways among attorney generals in not only all the standard things that attorney generals do, which are plentiful, but also in terms of litigation, essentially protecting, arguing, or advocating for rights of states vis-a-vis the federal government and resisting what he and others have reviewed as some encroachments on that. Attorney General Pruitt's been a national leader in the effort to challenge some of the executive actions of the Obama administration. He created Oklahoma's first federalism unit in the Attorney General's office. He's also been a leading advocate in terms of leading the charge against some of the proposed Environmental Protection Agency clean power plans and waters of the U.S., which rules tend to have the effect of displacing state sovereignty. He was before being elected Attorney General. He was in the state Senate, and he has been, in addition to some of these things, a stalwart friend of the Federalist Society. And we are delighted and honored to have him open our conference today. Attorney General Pruitt.
Well, good morning to you. It is a pleasure to be with you. I've always wanted to be at this meeting. In fact, Leonard and Jonathan and Gene have invited me to this gathering each of the last 2 to 3 years, and it hasn't worked out. I've always wanted to come to this library and spend time just thinking about history and the leadership of Ronald Reagan. One of my dear friends, as I've served as Attorney General, is Attorney General Ed Meese. General Meese and I have worked together on many issues, and I can't think of a more consummate gentleman than General Meese in the entire country. And as I said to some others earlier, that tells you a lot about the person he served. And it's wonderful to be at this library and actually get a chance to speak to you as well. Last night, as I was having dinner with Gene came up and said, "I'm so sorry to hear about the college football playoffs." He thought that I was an Oklahoma State Cowboy fan. And I'm not. I'm an Oklahoma Sooner fan, so the playoffs work pretty well. My daughter actually is attending the university and as a cheerleader there. And I heard all these stories about young folks when they go off to college that they don't stay in touch. You know, they don't write, they don't text, they don't call. And it's abundantly true. It's absolutely true. McKenna only calls and reaches out when she needs money, which is quite often. But I read with interest the story about a young lady who wrote home after school had started, and she had not, true to form, stayed in touch. And she sent a little letter to her dad and said, "Dear Dad, everything's good here at school. The dorm did burn down, and I did lose all my personal effects and textbooks, but I found a new place off campus to live with a new roommate, Jim. And Jim's doing really well. He's been in recovery for almost 6 months now. And I know that I've not stayed in touch, and I fully understand why you didn't make it to the wedding, but I know that you're not going to miss the impending birth of your new grandchild." And so she signs it and then puts a P.S. at the bottom. "Dad, everything above is untrue. I did flunk chemistry. I just wanted you to keep things in perspective." And let me say to you, as Attorney General in the state of Oklahoma, and as state attorneys general across the country, we have to keep things in perspective often, because the world that we've lived really since 2010 has been a very different world in some respects than what attorneys general have faced historically. Many across this country look at our offices and what we do as attorneys general, and they think that it's predominantly criminal. Just as a side comment, about 40% of my office, I would put in the criminal side of things. 60% or so is civil litigation and related to that. But Since 2010, the role and the scope and the responsibility of the attorney generals across this country, state attorneys general, I think have been very significant. I recall in March of 2010 when the original Affordable Care Act challenge was filed by a collection of 26 states, and as you know, Virginia filed first, and then there was a collection of 26 states, which Florida led that coalition. Oklahoma did not report to duty until I was elected in January of 2011, and so we added a lawsuit in Oklahoma, so there were 28 states. But as that litigation began in March of 2010, if you go back and read the commentary, if you go back and read the articles and the punditry and what they were saying, what did you read most often? It was all about politics, that it was political theater, that the attorneys general at the state level were engaged in simply an exercise of making the president look bad during an election year. That's what you read in March of 2010. That's what you heard throughout that year. 2 years later, I was in the Supreme Court. Pam Bondi, the attorney general in Florida, myself, and Ken Cuccinelli, the attorney general of Virginia, set front row as Paul Clement argued the Affordable Care Act case. For 3 days, the Supreme Court took argument, and it was quite vindicating to hear Supreme Court justices ask the very same questions that attorneys general had been asking for 2 years prior. And the reason I mention that to you is because of this. The cases that I'm involved in as attorney general, some of those cases that Gene mentioned that I'm going to talk about today, the narrative on the left, the narrative with respect to our opponents, is that we're simply engaging in political exercise. That it's an exercise in just simply trying to do what is popular and not do what's legal. And let me say to you, the opposite is true. It is a very important time to be serving as Attorney General because this is about rule of law, things that are much more transcendent, in my view, than whether we agree or disagree with the policy aspirations of the Affordable Care Act, or whether we disagree with the policy aspirations of the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act. And I want to talk about a couple of those cases. It's much more fundamental than that. It's about how we do business as a country. It's about whether we're going to respect rule of law. It's about whether we're going to respect horizontal checks and balances. You know, I talk often in the state of Oklahoma and across the country that everyone gets the separation of powers, or most people do. Sometimes it's arguable that the president does not. But fifth grade civics teaches you that the horizontal checks and balances between the branches is essential to ensuring our freedom and liberties. But what is not talked about often is vertical checks and balances. The founders understood that we needed horizontal between the branches, but there's also something they put inherent in the Constitution, vertical checks and balances, that the federal government is a government of enumerated power, specific power, and you know that. But you look at what's going on in Washington, D.C. today, and it's not playing out that way. And so these cases really are about ensuring that framework is respected. These cases sometimes are about just fundamental notions of rule of law. And I want to mention a couple to you up front as far as what I see out on the horizon right now, but I also want to talk to you a little bit about state overreach in a second, because I think that's often overlooked as well. The first case I'll talk to you about, and that I think is really, really important, is this Waters of the United States challenge that we see from a collection of 30-plus states. I don't know if you have followed that rule and the finalization of that rule that occurred last year, but the EPA issued and finalized a rule that changed the definition of what constitutes a water of the United States. Historically, and from a contextual standpoint, a textual standpoint, the statute, the Waters of the United States requires navigability, which makes sense because of the Interstate Commerce Clause, and that's the view. And there's been some court cases that have caused some confusion about that navigability requirement. And so the EPA thought that they would address that by providing a clarification, as they called it, to those that are regulated in the industry. And so they issued a rule to provide that clarification, and that rule fundamentally changed what constitutes a water of the United States by saying that no longer is navigability in fact required. It's just simply a nexus to navigability. So in western Oklahoma, Altus, Oklahoma, where Vance Air Force Base is located, I was in Altus, Oklahoma about 18 months ago, a year to 18 months ago, and as I was visiting the Air Force Base there, that city, that town, that area was within 12 or so months of not having drinking water. I know that you are going through some very significant drought conditions here in California. We have experienced that in the state, in the western part of our state. And so there are dry creek beds in Altus, Oklahoma, that are dry 90% of the year. We actually had heavy rains last year throughout the state. I understand that you're getting ready to have those as well. I hope that you do a little bit later this month. But we've had heavy rains in 2015. And there was standing water in those dry creek beds 10% of the year. Guess what the EPA said? The EPA said that they had jurisdiction over that dry creek bed. That if there was any oil and gas or farming and ranching or the building of a subdivision, any use of that land that would somehow affect that dry creek bed, the first stop was going to be the EPA for permitting authority. That's what this WOTUS, Waters of the United States rule, dictated and established for folks all over the country. And so state attorneys general, 30-plus states joined together, Oklahoma, North Dakota, and others, to challenge this Waters of the United States rule. And fortunately, recently the Sixth Circuit issued a ruling that said that a stay is in effect. They affirm that. And we have certainty across the country for those that are regulated that they're not facing fines and penalties for not heeding the EPA's jurisdiction or supposed jurisdiction over these dry creek beds like in Altus, Oklahoma. But that is an example of state attorneys general acting in a way that is not historically where we know of multi-states. Attorneys general have acted in that way with, you know, taking on fraud and the Medicaid context or other things with pharmaceutical companies, but you've not seen attorneys general and states joining together in coalitions like the original Affordable Care Act case, 28 strong, or this case of 30 plus, trying to make a difference to ensure that the EPA does something very, very, I think, important, heed the statute that the legislative body has passed. You know, we live in a really interesting time. Because we have an attitude amongst federal agencies that they can use Chevron deference to take a statute and say, you know, I think maybe this is a little bit better on how we should interpret that and how we should pursue that. I don't think that's really what the statute means. And fundamentally, they're changing the very language of a statute. And that's not really editorial comment. In many instances, it's unapologetic what these agencies are doing in that regard. And so it's putting the states in a defensive posture. And the WOTUS case is one example of those. Another case is the immigration context. And I know that you know that 26 states strong have joined together in that case. And that's an example of a different type of challenge. You know, the Waters of the United States is more about statutory language and whether an agency is adhering to that statutory language as they are adopting rules and regulations. But the immigration issue is a horse of a different color. It's an example of the executive branch saying, because Congress has not acted, because Congress has not acted the way that the executive thinks that they should, that the executive can fill in the space, can pinch hit, if you will, for Congress. And we were talking last night at dinner, the legislative prerogative is to act or not act. We know that Congress has the power and authority to reform our immigration and naturalization laws, and I'm one of those individuals that believe that they should and they must. It's obviously broken, it's dysfunctional, but it's their responsibility. And for the President of the United States to stand before the American people and say, because they have not acted, I will in their place, is fundamentally inconsistent with our constitutional framework. And so 26 states joined together and said, you can't do that. And as you know, received a stay at the district court level, affirmed by the Fifth Circuit. And the Justice Department thought that they could accelerate review of that this year and went to the U.S. Supreme Court and asked the U.S. Supreme Court to simply deal with what? The stay. But something wonderful happened from my perspective. The U.S. Supreme Court said, no, we're not just going to consider the stay. We're going to consider the underlying constitutional issue about whether the executive branch has violated the take care provisions of their responsibilities under the Constitution. That is a good, good sign, in my estimation, that this court is going to take seriously that the executive branch can't pinch hit for the legislative branch and fill in the void when it doesn't act the way that the president wants to. That's a good, encouraging sign. So you see the states joining together. None of us at the state level, at least the folks that I'm aware of, argue that the federal government doesn't have authority, that they don't have the power, that the states somehow should do it in the place of Washington, D.C. We're simply saying it's your responsibility to do that, and if you choose not to, the executive branch can't fill in that void in that space. So we'll see what happens in that matter. As I understand it, that's going to be argued in April and during election year. So it's going to be very interesting to see what occurs. One other area that I want to chat with you about that is not discussed often. Jonathan Bunch and Leonard and I have talked about this quite a bit. is the notion of state overreach. You know, attorneys general have been very animated, very involved in responding to agency overreach, executive overreach, the imbalance of power between the federal and state governments in a justifiable and, I think, very necessary way, from the Affordable Care Act to Dodd-Frank to the energy areas that I've talked about already. But what is not addressed oftentimes is the dynamic of state overreach. And it's been a focus of mine as Attorney General in Oklahoma. And let me tell you what we are doing and what we're addressing. You know, oftentimes you'll have companies, Airbnb, Uber, Lyft, companies that just a little bit north of here in the Menlo Park area, Andreessen Horowitz, the Founders Fund, VC firms, they're very involved in companies that disrupt the delivery of transportation or other types of services. And as those disruptive companies come into a marketplace in Oklahoma City, in Tulsa, in Columbus, or wherever it is across this country, you have regulatory bodies that have existed for decades, that have statutes that have existed for decades, and they're taking those statutes and they're taking the regulatory authority and they're making some presumptions. They're actually saying, well, clearly we should regulate, we should involve ourselves with Airbnb and Uber and Lyft, although those companies may perhaps, they don't fit the framework. They don't fit the statutory definitions. They don't fit the regulatory oversight and responsibility of that body. And the reason it's happening is because the stakeholders that those regulatory bodies have regulated for decades, it's almost a form of protectionism. They're saying, go regulate them because otherwise it's going to affect our market share. And so there's a protectionist mindset that's taking place at the state level that is not entirely consistent with the statutory language and the authority that's granted to these regulatory bodies locally. And so as Attorney General, we've begun a survey. I've been going through our statutes. I've been working with our agencies, and I've done two or three things. I've gone to my general counsel unit internal to my office, and I've said, as you advise these regulatory agencies, you need to make sure that they're not engaging in overreach, much like we see out of these federal agencies. And so it's happening through, you know, normal advice and counsel. But I'm also issuing AG opinions, which obviously take on a little bit more force and effect, because agencies in Oklahoma, as an AG opinion is issued, it's the full force of law. It's like a judge issuing an order, and they have to comply with that AG opinion unless and until, which doesn't happen often, I hope, a judge disagrees. And so we are exercising some kind of judicial, a quasi-judicial oversight of these regulatory bodies as it relates to their use of statutes in a way that is not entirely consistent with their authority. And that's very important. But another area that we've engaged in is the recent decision, the FTC decision with the Board of Dentistry in North Carolina. As you know, the Supreme Court issued a ruling last year that said that sometimes these agencies at the state level are populated by a majority of market participants, sometimes. And in Oklahoma, we have hundreds of boards and commissions. Very populous state. Our Constitution has taken a lot of power away from the executive, if you will, invested it in boards and commissions. Some of those members are appointed by the governor, sometimes not so much. And so it's really been a dispersion of power to boards and commissions. And a large percentage of those are boards and commissions that are dominated by market participants, the pharmacist and other types of examples. And so the Supreme Court said, if you have a board or commission that's a majority of market participants, then it's possible that as they issue their decisions, they can engage in what? Anti-competitive conduct. And as they engage in anti-competitive conduct, unless there's some sort of state oversight that ensures that the state interest is what's being advanced as opposed to a market participant interest is being advanced, then the antitrust protections that inure to the benefit of those boards of commission goes away. And so I took that opinion last year and sent a little letter to my governor, Governor Fallon, who's a friend. I said, Governor, we've got to engage in a more concrete, intentional oversight of these boards and commissions, or potentially the protections that it attached to those board members will go away if it's interpreted that they've engaged in anti-competitive conduct. Guess what the governor said? She said, that sounds good, you do it. So we don't have enough going on in my shop. I mean, it's the only job I've ever had, by the way, that I wake up and say, who sued me today? And so we've got plenty going on. I wasn't looking for work, but I got it anyway. I got it nonetheless. And so the governor said, you do that. So now my office, in addition to the GC role, in addition to the AG opinions, We're engaged in a review of decision-making that's going on by these boards and commissions to determine and make sure that it's not anti-competitive, that it's not protectionism to the point of just benefiting certain individuals, picking winners and losers, if you will, in the market, as opposed to advancing a safety and health type of interest of the state of Oklahoma. And let me say to you, just something editorially for a second, I think the greatest impediment we have in the country today as far as economic growth is not tax policy, it's regulatory policy. And it's not even the weight of regulatory policy. A lot of folks will talk about that. We'll talk about the number of regulations that are coming out, and it's quite substantial. I think the challenge that we see in this country is the inconsistency in the regulatory framework. Of those in the industry knowing what is to be expected. I was spending time with a healthcare administrator of a major hospital in Muskogee, Oklahoma, 18 months or so ago. And I asked this gentleman, I said, how do you make decisions? How do you make decisions 3 and 5 years ahead? The deployment of capital, the retention of personnel, you know, the vision for the future. How do you do that? And he said, I can't. He said, because of these regulatory bodies at the federal level, around the ACA and otherwise, is changing so rapidly. We look at the statute, and we think the statute says this very, very clearly, and then you have an agency doing something completely different. And so we have no idea what's, and there's paralysis that's occurring. That's happening in the energy context. It's happening in the banking context. It's happening in the healthcare context. It is the most damning thing that I see with respect to our ability to grow as a country. And what does that all go back to? Rule of law, checks and balances, and our system of government, knowing where those that are investing dollars can have confidence in the structures and the law. There's a phrase that I use in my office quite often, lex rex. The law is above the king. We need to live that in this country. We need to live it in the regulatory context and the rest, and that's part of what we're trying to do, not just with respect to the federal overreach, but also with state overreach. I'll close with that because I know Gene and Jonathan, Lisa and others wanted to have a few moments at the end for a Q&A, and I hope that I can spend some time and answer any questions you might have and be of help to you. But I do want you to know this, and I said this at the very beginning. These matters are not matters of politics or policy for me. I was asked last night if you have a statute, if you have a constitutional amendment to your constitution that you disagree with, what do you do, Scott? And my response was, I do my job. I defend that statute with which I disagree. I defend that constitutional, that's my responsibility. That's how our system works. And we are living in a day and time where those that we put in elected office to do those things or appointed office at the federal level, that they somehow think it's preferential to say, I kind of don't like that law or I don't like that statute. And that happened, I think, here in California not too long ago. And it's happened in Virginia and it's happened at the federal level. That's just simply not how we should do business. We need to get back to the basics, make sure that we do our jobs as elected officials and appointed officials, but also enforce rule of law and maintain checks and balances. Teddy Roosevelt one time said, in any given situation, the best thing you can do is the right thing. The next best thing you can do is the wrong thing. The worst thing you can do is nothing. And I can tell you, I'm so thankful that I walk with a number of attorneys general across the country that we're living by that very admonition of Teddy Roosevelt. We are taking steps that are focused on the law, transcendent issues that will preserve our ways into the future. And I'm hopeful that we can make a difference and set the precedent as opposed to what we see coming out of the executive branch at the federal level and otherwise. So thank you for the time. It's good to be with you. I wish you well in your discussion today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thanks very much. This young man here, he looks very dapper today. You know, my pink tie's a little bit more hip, though. But anyway, he's got a mic back there, so anybody have a question? No, you can't ask one.
It's on? It works? No, I'm just the mic guy, so if you guys have any questions, I'm the guy who gives it to you. So any questions? Okay, wait.
(Clears throat)
General Pruitt, thank you so much. Ramon Bueller with the Madison Coalition. Thank you so much for your leadership on state issues. And my question is, the attorney generals right now are kind of in the position of supplicants to the king. They go to the king, they go on bended knee, they ask the Supreme Court, please, please do
what I only wish the president saw it that way, but go ahead.
And of course, we have no idea whether in the next 10 years we're going to get a really better Supreme Court or a really worse Supreme Court. And you and I have discussed this further before, but I'd be interested in your thoughts. As you know, there are now 500 state legislators and four governors and the General Counsel of the Republican National Committee and the American Farm Bureau and some others who think that the way to fix the problems in Washington is the same way that states forced Congress to propose the Bill of Rights, not with a convention, but by forcing Congress to do the right thing. And this group and others are now working to persuade Congress to propose something called a Regulation Freedom Amendment to require that Congress approve major new federal regulations. And my question is, what role do you think attorney generals who've already united in lawsuits might be able to play if they decided that states should work together to fix this problem permanently, not just with by one judicial decision at a time?
Now, are you referring partially to the RAINS Act?
The Regulation Freedom Amendment is the constitutional version of the RAINS Act.
Right.
It would require that Congress approve major new federal regulations.
No, I think that both are meritorious and both are needed. What I can say is that the way that we're doing business presently, it's going to take a major disruption. It's going to take a major change in thinking. And here's why. The founders believed that the branches would be ambitious. They believed that each of the branches would be ambitious and would jealously guard their role. That's not happening today. The legislative branch is not ambitious. Congress is more than willing to delegate, and I think unconstitutionally. And I understand the courts historically have been deferential to delegation of congressional authority, because in some respects it's considered activism for a court to step in and say who would step in and keep them from giving their own power away. But I think in some respects the courts and action, as you're describing, Roman, are going to be necessary to change the way that we're doing business, because it's too easy for those that are elected to go to Congress and say, I'm going to exaggerate to make a point, we like clean air, so go make clean air. And then when the EPA takes a step to do that, they go back to Oklahoma and California, and maybe not California, but they come back to other states and they say, well, we didn't do that. The EPA did that. You know, we didn't do that. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did that. And so, Roman, I think that that is a problem that has to be addressed in a substantive, meaningful way, because the political pulse and impulse is such that there's not a desire to lead. There's not a desire to make decisions. And we need our elected representatives making those decisions accountable to the people and not delegating those authorities to regulatory bodies. Otherwise, it's going to be an abuse of the system, and I think we're living it right now. What can we do? I don't know. You can advise and give me input on that as we talk about that as a group of attorneys general, but I think it's very meritorious. What other questions do you have?
Mr. Attorney, thank you, Mr. Attorney General, for taking my question.
Yes, sir.
You spoke about the regulatory excesses and how some of the market participants might have an interest in their regulations. I'd like to give you a concrete example here. And the underlying issue is about this rational basis test. I represent a very small evening law school in the counties of Santa Barbara and Ventura. We cater to a very different demographic, working adults, single parents. Some of our graduates, one was an Afro-American who was homeless, who came to our law school and passed the bar on her first attempt. But the California bar regulates law schools as well. And recently, out of the blue, they came up with a regulation saying that unless our schools have a 40% pass rate or something like that over a rolling five-year period, the school loses its accreditation. They gave no reasons for that 40% rule. So we took it to the Ninth Circuit. And a panel of the Ninth Circuit, in an unpublished opinion, wrote that the state bar does not have to give any reasons, any conceivable basis would be sufficient for its rules. Now, we have filed a writ of certiorari to the United States Supreme Court, and we are claiming that this rational basis test does not, you know, mean what another circuit court has referred to as judicial blindness, that they have to provide some reason at least, even if there is a conceivable purpose, at least some reason to defend their regulations. My question then is, how does this rational basis test play in when you examine the legislation from states and agency officials, and especially like with the state bar, where there are market participants as well?
I think the most rational thing I could do probably is not respond to that question. in the sense that I probably want to know a little bit more about the case. And by the way, you're very persuasive. So it sounds like the writ of certiorari may have some persuasion to it. But at the same time, I think that it's probably best for me not to engage in a case-specific discussion about that. I don't know. Has there been an amicus request that any states have expressed an interest? Do you know about any state participation as far as an amicus in support of your writ?
We have not. It's in conference for February the 19th. But the broader question is, how does one deal with this very amorphous rational basis test in assessing, you know, the validity of legislation and this regulatory exercises that...
Well, as you know, there's quite a bit of discussion at the federal level right now, and I can't recall the court. Was it the Seventh Circuit that... I heard about this yesterday. I wonder if Jonathan is it. Jonathan, is that right? The Seventh Circuit talked about the Chevron deference? Yeah. In any event, I mean, there's a lot of discussion around that as far as the Supreme Court visiting... issues of deference that have been traditionally lodged with agencies. Agencies, the reason you have administrative agencies is they supposedly do have expertise. You know, the reason you have boards and commissions is that you have market participants that understand the dynamic of medicine or law or otherwise. Now, the real concern is, can it be abused? And the answer is yes. And I think that states, in our state of Oklahoma, we actually have a statute that the Tenth Circuit said was constitutional, but we have a statute that says that you can only buy a casket from a funeral director or from a funeral home. You can't buy it from anybody else, you know. And so the states routinely engage in protectionism. The courts have allowed that to occur. And so the key is making sure that it's a state acting as opposed to market participants acting. And those endos for self-interest or, you know, trying to pick winners and losers within the context of whatever regulated industry you're talking about. And so that's fact-specific. That's going to be something that would be borne out, but I do think that we do need to address the larger concerns of deference and what that means for agencies, both at the federal and state level. And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be evasive. I just don't. I want to speak more generally than maybe to the specific case with respect, if I can. So, any other tough questions? Yes, sir, in the very back. Yeah, and I think that an Article 5 Convention of the States is something that I am more interested and supportive of than perhaps I was in the past. I think that many are concerned, obviously, about a runaway convention, and understandably so, but there's something called ratification on the back end that I think is a tremendous safeguard against any type of runaway convention. And so it goes back to Roman's question earlier. I mean, we are living in a time where There are certain prescriptions the founders put in the Constitution to deal with the imbalances that we see presently. And I think we need to consider all of those in order to maintain the proper balance between the federal and state government. And if we don't, we're going to see a continuation of this of these abuses. Hey, it's been a wonderful time to be with you in California. I've had a great stay. Gene didn't mention this to you, but I owned a AAA baseball team in Oklahoma City, and the Pacific Coast League was our league, and we traveled to Fresno and Sacramento, and we were all in this part of the country, and So Yogi Berra is one of my favorite philosophers. I don't know about yours, but he's one of my favorite philosophers. And I was thinking my stay in California has been, you know, so good. I thought about that quote of Yogi. He said, you know what? The towels were so thick I couldn't fit them in my suitcase. So, and that's kind of like the hotel we stayed at. But anyway, it's good to see you. I wish you well during your conference today. And it is an important time. And you're hanging out in a good place, and you're hanging out with good folks. And what the Federalist Society stands for, the partnership that attorneys general have with the Federalist Society, Leonard and Jonathan and the entity itself and Gene and the rest, we are making a difference to advance principles that I think are important for limited government and for our future as far as liberty. And it's been a joy to be with you, and now I'm going to go see the plane upstairs. But thank you very much.